I don't know really how to put to you what I have to say. I've been asked to give you my ideas about woman, about the stages through which we women have to go. Now, I really don't know what I'm supposed to say about stages. I'm not even sure that there are any stages in the life of woman. Stages seem to me too clearly defined to apply to woman, unless I accept very simply expressed developmental terms like baby, little girl, bigger girl, adolescent girl, young woman, old woman, and such like terms. In any case, I consider myself, if I consider myself at all, to be quite unfit to pronounce on the requested subject. Certainly not in any objective sense that would be likely to be acceptable to the male members of our society. Nevertheless, I have been asked to do with the subject the best I can. And as I fear as a woman that everything I say will turn out more mysteriously than I intend, yet I hope that what emerges will not be without interest, and may even perhaps turn out to be of some service, although to whom I'm in some doubt. As the women amongst us will know, we really have no other purpose in life but to be of service. Of course, especially to the men to whom we pledge ourselves. But perhaps I should not generalize. Perhaps I should speak only of myself and of my own experience. But something in me, and I suspect it is the woman in me, feels quite happy to include all women in one. For I don't believe that women, as the scholastics would say, as such, are in any way essentially different. Of course, we women differ physically in length of hair and noses and legs and in degree of roundness and flatness and height or shortness and in skin colour, from dead white through various degrees of paleness and darkness and such forth. But such differences are not essential. The only essentials for woman are the qualities of relational intention, which confer upon her the power of feeling, emotion, and physicality. I don't mean that woman can't think, but that if she does, it is usually about these three qualities. Little girls are not like little boys. Little boys delight in pulling their toys to pieces. They seem to be driven to do this in order to find out how they work. Knowledge of know-how of things seems to be their chief pursuit. It is said of little boys, in justification of their destructive tendencies, that they have analytical minds. They take the clock to pieces in order to find out what makes it tick, and as soon as they've found out, they pass on to other things. They do not so much tend to reassemble the parts of the clock. Its mystery unveiled, they move off in search of something else with another kind of pick problem to solve. Big grown-up boys and men show similar tendencies to delve into mysteries, and once disclosed, to pass off in their march towards further disclosures. And we women do not fail to note the resemblances in the activities of little boys, bigger boys, and men. But as we gain a little in maturity, we begin to acquire the art of self-containment about such things. I'm not supposed to be talking about boys and men, but about women, and especially the stages through which they go, their lives must pass. Well, then, back to the subject matter. To the best of my ability, I shall try to recall the stages of life through which so far I have passed. Although I'm not personally quite convinced that there are any stages that we women as such go through, that there are any clearly defined stages, except perhaps the one in which we gain the power to conceive and so to become mothers. I have accepted the suggestion to divide the lifespan into periods each 7 years long, and these grouped into three. The first seven concerning itself with investigative action, the second with an acquisition of knowledge, and the third with revolt against the sources of that knowledge. And what effect this mode of division will have on what I have to say, I've yet to find out. In searching in my memory, I find that I remember most strongly those events of my life in which my feelings and emotions have been involved. And this doesn't surprise me, because as a woman I tend to live my life within such levels. But I'll try to correct this tendency a little with a little hard thinking, but not too much, so that I might be able to manage to reduce the amount of irritation that the more intellectual members of our circle might otherwise experience. To help me in my memory search, I've made a number of masks, and I have put these on the table as on the table of the law. And each mask is mounted on a short stick for me to hold, the more easily to show it to you. The masks, I hope, will make it unnecessary for me to overtax my powers in that room. And they'll also save time that I would otherwise have to consume in makeup changes. And also, they'll give you something of a rest from having to look at me as I am in my present state. The first mask I will show you, I have marked zero. It pictures myself at the moment of my conception. As you see, it is rather like a circle of moonshine protoplasm, into which has inserted itself the head of a certain male element, which has left its little tail hanging out, rather like a beard of a young man about town. I stay in the womb 10 lunar months, 9 on the calendar, I think, during which time I pass through my chief ancestral stages, in which I am modelled into the form proper to human beings at this stage of our development. And I will not bother such a knowledgeable audience as your dear selves with the details of the numerous embryonic morphological stages through which a fertilized ovum must pass in order to attain humanization. But I will pass on to the face I wore at my first entrance in trance into this outer physical world. This face will cover my first 7 years. True, it will lose its first simple roundness, somewhat lengthening a little as the sense of I-ness begins to develop, and its primal innocence fades gradually away. In this first 7 years, I have only one job to do, to discover the possibilities of action of the physical body, in which I find myself incarnate and my consciousness trapped. So I use my body the best way I can, and in every way I can think of. I lie, stand, sit, walk, run, row, stand on my head, turn cartwheels, and try everything I can think of, and some things that I can't think of, but somehow am impelled by the life force in me to try. And always while I'm engaged in discovering the possibilities of physical body activities, I keep a sly eye open to note the effects of my behavior on the grown-ups around me. I'm seeking effective tricks by which to capture their attention. The tricks that work I will retain all my life, unless better other conjurings offer themselves. And I may tell you between ourselves that I have now given up trying to gain attention by cartwheeling. Well, there comes an end to the acrobatics of physicality. At a certain moment in time, I realize that I have exhausted my Olympic gymnastic capacities. And I feel rather surprising that I've somehow missed some essential trick. I can't think what it is. But somehow the grown-ups, the power holders, are not sufficiently impressed and not brought totally under my control. There is something else I must learn, and I don't know what it is. It sinks into my mind that if I can't think what it is, then I'll have to ask somebody outside myself what it is. And I'll have to swallow my little girl chutzpah and ask the power holders, the adults, for help. Somehow, I make my way into my second 7 years. The years in which I will have to add to my physical repertory of tricks the more subtle ones of the mind. What I feel I now need is a larger vocabulary, and for this I must formulate questions which will wrest from the grown-ups the innermost secrets of their power and authority. To this end, I pester every grown-up within reach, plying them incessantly with questions. Why is this, and what is that, and why does this do this or that? And where is whatever it is? Well, of course, my mother suffers most from this new orientation, and after her, my father, and after these, my favorite aunts and uncles. That is, the ones who have treated me most kindly. There is no subject in the world that does not catch my interest. I am determined to leave no mystery veiled, no forbidden territory uninvaded. And I promise myself that I will become the most informed, the most knowledgeable person in the world, indeed, in the whole universe. And I race recklessly towards my goal, rubbing on the way the contents of every adult's mind. At last, I come to the end of my second 7 years. My mental cabinet of Dr. Caligari, crammed with the revealed wisdom of grown-up claimants to omniscience. Their ever tighter and tighter grip, their overbearing authority becomes unbearable. I have sucked empty their generation gap brains, and their myriad inconsistencies now batter to pieces within my immature skull. I am about to enter my third 7 years, the years of my first conscious revolt against external authorities. All revolts begin when the nonsense of government becomes apparent. Try as they will to maintain the trappings of authority and power, illogical governments betray their own deep insecurities in a thousand little ways. The braid of sanctioned decorations wears a little thin at the edges, and the decorated ones smile wanly and say that incorruptibility is a counsel of perfection. No one, they say, in this world is perfect. Grown-ups know in their heart of hearts their fallibility, and so they fear the rising generation that they themselves have introduced into the world. Fear tends to lead to suppression of the feared ones and of any information that might tend to lead towards revolt. Perfection is allowed for the post-mortem world, to which ascend young heroes killed on the battlefields of righteous wars. But it has no place, they say, in this world of ours. But earthly revolutions presuppose that someone believes in the possibility of earthly perfection. Otherwise, revolutions would be stupid. Certainly, myself as a woman wouldn't revolt at all, for I hate destructive conflict and would rather make love than war. But something inside me drives me to revolt whenever I come into the presence of irrational authorities. Somewhere inside me stirs a memory of once enjoyed perfection. Freud would say that this is but an omnipotent fantasy derived from my prenatal life in the womb, where my every wish as wished was at once fulfilled. I have no feeling of omnipotence, but rather a fear of possible destruction of my being. So I turn from Freud to Plato, who holds that my soul pre-existed my life in time, and that I lived before this life in eternity, and there tasted of perfection, and that this once-tasted perfection is the source of my present belief in its possibility. In any case, the stirrings of such memories are certainly real to me, and by this I justify my revolt. In this revolutionary period, I tell my father and my mother how stupid they are and how outmoded their views. I tell them that I have seen through their omniscience, and that their authority is now no authority for me. I tell them that I didn't ask to be born. So I feel a little uneasy about this. And I tell them that any bad behavior of mine is a product of bad heredity, and that they are responsible for anything I do that they don't like. But strangely, I consider that any good or admirable qualities that I possess are not the product of heredity, but of my very own intelligence and goodwill. And so I am able to justify to my own satisfaction my revolt. And I'm somewhat surprised that they have difficulty in accepting my explanation. But finally, my revolt ends in the only possible way. I leave home. But somehow, I have been working hard. I've foreseen this possibility, and I've been working hard with all my machinery of tricks, physical and mental, to set up some kind of a relationship which I hope will provide me with an alternative mode of security. I found myself a boyfriend who, though he may not yet suspect it, has been selected to serve as my father's security substitute. And who is either the right one for the position, or who will do until the right one arrives. I am now 21, and although I haven't the key to the door of my parents' house, I have the key to the home of my boyfriend, or at least his student's room. I have completed my first three phases. I know what I can do on my own with my physical body. I have succeeded in gathering from grown-up brains whatever they thought they knew or pretended to know, and I have revolted against their authority. I am now ready for my next triplicity of sevens, and will repeat, though in a different way, my physical, mental, and revolutionary activities, this time with one other person, the boy of my choice. First, I must enter into physical relationship with him in order to disclose how my physical body can relate with another. To this end, I must persuade him to stand with me, to sit with me, to lie with me, and so forth. Whilst I extend with him my bodily awareness into territories impossible to the solo activist. This is the phase in which my self-love becomes diverted into love of another. I fall at the same love. Of course, I don't know what love is, but the word is current, and I have no reason not to use it. It offers sufficient cover for a multitude of not yet adequately defined motives. Also, it has social acceptability as an explanation for all kinds of fantastically formed idiocies. Birds and... Birds and animals perform some very peculiar tricks in the mating season, and humans are only a little less crazy. And all is fair in love and war, they say, a thought which allows much latitude in both. Personally, I suspect, from my observations of behavior in the animal world, that Mars and Venus, at the dawn of life on Earth, slept together. The likelihood of survival is as little different in an act of love as in an act of war. The biting of the neck of the lioness by the lion in an amorous moment might have led spontaneously to her becoming his dinner. Or if she were quick enough on the turnaround for him becoming hers. Well, whatever the realities behind these mysteries, I find myself for a time with the teeth of my father substitute in the back of my neck. And I feel, though a trifle ambiguously, safe for a while. I spend this period investigating the pleasure possibilities of two bodies instead of just one. I try for a few years with all the sincerity I can summon up from my depths to relate to my chosen one. I am determined to make make him, if possible, happy as a precondition to my own happiness, which I call our happiness. To this end, I try to explain the meaning of relationship. The beauty of the word and the fact, which I hope may correspond to it. But somehow, the word seems to frighten him, at least to cause him to retreat a little. But I am led to remember what little boys do when they've taken the clocks to bits, to find out what makes them tick. And I begin to wonder whether my loved one thinks he's found out how I tick. Something has gone wrong. There is something I don't know about how to manage a relationship for two. My will to relate to my beloved seems to affect him in peculiar ways that I cannot account for. I need more information. This time, about the art of dual relationship. If the word relationship makes my partner wince under the skin, I must find out why. If he cannot see that my intentions are sincere, I must find out how to make him do so. But sincerity itself seems to scare him. I feel that to him every sincere word clanks like a link in an iron chain that threatens to deprive him of his freedom. And I become sharply aware that he suspects that this chain will fasten me to him forever. I need new ideas to help me to understand how to secure our relationship. I read every book title that seems to offer me the information I need. The books themselves I find hard and tedious. Their vocabulary is wrong for me, so I can't find out whether their ideas are wrong or right. I talk to other women of my circle and hope to pump out of them surreptitiously whatever useful information they may possess. I have no intention of advertising my real position and my personal failure to handle the man of my choice. Women hate nothing more than betraying their own deficiencies to each other. We labor under no concepts of chivalry or honor such as those that press on men. I scrabble everywhere for the secret rules that control dual relationships. A few offered not by psychologists, but by great religious teachers I find very beautiful. But I seem unable to apply them in the real face-to-face encounter. Do good to those that use you badly. Turn the other cheek when already struck on one. Such things sound well on the lips, but something in me is somewhat dubious about them. If in the deepest center of my heart I acquiesce with them, yet personally I find myself not quite convinced. I become disgusted with the expert's advice on dual relationships. Quietly, secretly, I become disgusted with the experts themselves. Bush Telegraph tells me that they have problems of their own. And I have no free energy to spare to feel sorry for them, which fact is, I know, very unchristian of me. But it's so much easier to give good advice to other needy persons than to take it and apply it to oneself. So I come to my sixth phase. My second face of revolution. I revolt against all external authorities who offer techniques for handling dual relationships, love affairs and marriages and so forth. All I have to do, I am told, is to see the other's point of view. To see the other as a person and not as a thing. Have sympathy. Feel into the other's inner real self. Assume the other's deep inherent goodness and all will be well. But I can't see the other's point of view. I can see only my own, that not very clearly. And to see the other as a person is also beyond me. To see someone as a person, I would have to know what a person is. I know that a person isn't a thing, a stone or a block of wood, but what it really is in its essence, I don't know. A person is a mystery. And as for the other's inner real self, well, I don't know how to get at it. And as for deep inherent goodness, I feel as dubious about that as I do about my own. Although I'm hopeful that there might be enough to save us all from hellfire, if there is such a thing. Anyhow, I revolt against this second bunch of authorities and feel right to do so. If only because they don't confer on me the power to control my own reactions against my loved one's increasingly obvious incapacity to fulfill all my long-felt wants as soon as they arrive. I take up my seventh mark. Having failed to attain the highest conceivable bliss, whilst enfolded in the loving arms of one only lover, I begin to think that perhaps the closed dual relationship is not the one intended for me by fate, or by the divinity that is supposed to know what is best for us. I turn, therefore, to the group, a small group of friends who have somehow gathered around us, or to which we have attached ourselves, and perhaps here in the more varied personalities that cluster in our immediate environment, I will be able to avoid the strange gaps that have appeared in the merely dual relationship. But first, to still my stirring conscience, I ask my beloved if he will join the group with me. After all, I remember telling him, as women do, that we are sufficient for each other alone, and could be so forever on a desert island, or even in an old-style gypsy caravan, horse-drawn down old-style country roads, far from the motorway and multi-car crashes. So we tried first together a variety of clubs, tennis, golf, etc., and for a while collective ball games distract us from our isolation. But fairly quickly I recognize that most of the people in the group are there for the same reason as I, to escape the real difficulties of the dual relationship. Yet all of us persist in trying to make the group solutions work. Funnily enough, I observe that the group tends to fall into dual relations. Two's company, three's the crowd, and four tends to be a swap shop. The fact is that I don't know how to conduct myself effectively in the small group relationship. I need more information than I now have to turn myself into a real grouper. So, I take myself off to the paperback bookshop. My face is not yet sufficiently strong to allow me to pay the extra cost of hardback. After all, as I've said, I find it difficult to read more than titles, and perhaps a few pages at a book's beginning. And hardback seem to demand more serious attention than softbacks, and contain fewer references to the more intimate affairs of the heart. But I must drive myself to get the information I need, so I put on my serious grouper information seeker face, which I shall wear from 49 to 56. For I am very determined to find at least a few basic ideas on how to fit in. I try for me very hard to read through the books I choose. Their first pages prove this by the way they're turned back. But the treatment of the subject matter seems still too dry for my still feminine heart. And as I've only just entered this stage, I can't say too much about it. But already I think I can feel the first seeds of dissatisfaction with it, sprouting like my bean shoots in the kitchen. Probably at the end of this 7 years, when I'm 56, I shall enter into a new stage of revolution. Strangely enough, when at my present stage I ought to stop talking about my stage with any degree of authority, and at best should be content to offer mere speculations about any further stages that I have to pass through, I find appearing in my mind with some degree of clarity a group of ideas which refer to my future. To explain the presence of these ideas, I have to accept a cyclic view of reality. The idea that events repeat themselves sufficiently similarly to allow us to remember their main pattern. Plato, according to my reading, says that we see the form of our lives in eternity before we are born into the time process. Well, whatever the truth may be about this, it is a fact that I have the idea of already having been here before, so that although I am only 51, I can foresee the pattern of my years to come. Anyhow, my study of the small group living, meager as it may be, convinces me that the little group tends to limit the mental horizon and cramp the soul in a local clique vocabulary which voices little of the large issues of humanity. And if I try to express my interest in matters beyond the little group, their cool reception makes me aware that I'm beginning to be used as in something peculiar. I am suspected of not being a true, genuine little grouper. Like Alexander, I seek new worlds to conquer. So I find myself a revolutionary again, this time against the small group. I put on my ninth mask. My revolution this time is more thorough than my earlier one. The years fly by, characterized by cunning attempts on my part to withdraw from the little group without creating too much bad feeling and without overmuch blackening of my character. I contrive to extricate myself, utilizing various kinds of excuses, and all the while keeping my ears and eyes open for the news of a larger group, preferably embracing the whole universe. I put on mask number 10. The perennial philosophy and the great religions of the world in their distilled eclectic essence will, I feel, fill my larger needs. I see all small groups as but cells within the living body of the earth. I move towards the larger pangeic groups, organizations, and I find one with a fascinating title of the Brotherhood of Whole Earth Lovers. Well, I hesitate a moment before becoming a registered member, wondering why it's not called the Sisterhood of Earth Lovers. I quiet my mind against suspicions of male chauvinism by telling myself that brotherhood really includes, by implication, sisterhood. And the presence of so many ladies of my age in the brotherhood justifies my interpretations. And the mysterious glances of the expensively dressed, well-managed chairman of the brotherhood also convinces me that now I am in the right community. And so I decide that this earth-loving brother-sisterhood is for me. It is the end of my search for meaning. My life is now finally to be fulfilled. And yet, as I reach my 70th year, I feel somehow that I have missed the mark again. My position in the brother-sisterhood, or sister-brotherhood, as I prefer to think of it, is not what I would like it to be. There is something wrong with the organization's government. The teacher here hasn't given me the truth I need and long for. I must gain more information of the Pangaic truth on which the brotherhood is founded. I need authority of validity to help me. I read and question the Brotherhood's leaders, and I find them cagey on certain matters which appear to me very important. I begin to doubt the validity of their authority. I am on for my next revolution, the new revolutionary period, my fourth, will last from 77 to 84. It will be a revolution against all external authorities, whatever. And here I feel that I am sufficiently matured to confer on myself the most honorable title of Mahama. The Great Mother, the cosmic brotherhood of the enlightened, now lies far beneath me. Never again will I listen to directives from what I now know to be inferior beings. I scorn their advice and poo-poo their wisdom. So I reach the end of my fourth revolutionary period. I turn away from all earthly authority. Now I must fly beyond our tiny terrestrial globe to make of myself a true cosmopolitan, a citizen of the great cosmos, the universe of the starry realms. There perhaps I might at last find that for which my heart has been so long yearned for. There perhaps will I find my dream lover, who will solve all my problems for me. There, far beyond the fantasies of earth-bound sexuality, will I find my true spiritual husband, my stellar spouse, in whose indigo blue eyes I will see myself, regardless of my terrestrial and physical age, as I really am, in the great world of spiritually developed, enlightened ones. So, I take the yellow pages. And I look for and find the address and telephone number of the mystical order of cosmic Illuminati. Naturally, they accept my application for full life membership. Which might, if I take my initiatory examinations with due seriousness and infinite dedication, become eternal. Obviously, I shall, as my initiator informs me, become one of the immortals of the MOCI, or Mockies, as we secretly call ourselves. But of course, again, I don't know yet. I don't know enough to receive the privilege of full membership of the Mockies, so I have to put on my Mockie student's mask. But alas, the other students all around my own age seem singularly unhelpful, and the Mockie Supreme Master doesn't seem in a very great hurry to confer on me by means of the advertised, but absolutely secret, highest initiatory rite, that which will confer my new spiritual immortality and the high title of Illuminated Super Supremissima! So, off I go again into revolution. I put on mask 15. I am sure this time that this will be my last revolution against external authorities. Somewhere deep down inside me, as deep as my bones, to which I daily feel nearer and nearer, I know what I've always known but not wanted to know. I shall have finally to give up all external authorities whatever and find in the center of my own long-neglected self my one supreme authority. I put on the mask. Of complete self-authority. I look forward to the innumerable years ahead. The years in which I shall stand on my own, my very own self-authority. At my age, I'm sure that it's legitimate for me to do so. Finally, to make up my own mind and never again to look outside myself for life's direction. I now see myself as empress of my own soul, a supreme Mahama to myself and to any one of the untold millions of lesser souls on whom I care to bestow at any moment my imperial favor. Upon such I shower decorations, ribbons, medals, parchment scrolls inscribed with the highest honors. That is, if they recognize my supreme status, which they might in their blind ignorance and rebelliousness not do. For it is a repeated fact that some people are so foolish as to revolt against even God himself. But time continues to pass on, and I become uneasily aware of some kind of deficiency in me. In spite of the surety of my feeling of great power and self-authority, I become gradually convinced that I don't yet recognize inside myself all the qualities that I shall need and must have in order to make absolutely authoritative statements to myself. I do not see inside myself all that I shall need to make it possible for me to keep my imperial position on my self-designed sumptuous throne. The supreme self-authority that is absolutely necessary for me at all times to be able to control myself and the mysterious impulses that arise in my being. Otherwise, I shall never be able to do freely whatever I will to do. I cannot afford to allow my organism to dictate to me. I cannot afford myself to let myself be swayed by feelings and emotions, the wishes, wants, and desires that periodically sweep through my soul. I must learn somehow to know myself thoroughly. I put on my 17th mask, the mask of the utterly sincere student of the science and art of supreme self-authority. I examine myself to disclose the ground of my essential nature. I probe into my deepest depth of depths. I pass through the sacred portal of that most difficult and most esoteric study of all, the study of the self that has transcended all external authorities whatever, and must now find somewhere in its deepest center the very ground and the root and the meaning of absolute authority itself. I search and search. I descend to depths never before penetrated by woman. Nothing less than the attaining of absolute authority will satisfy me. I seek and I find. Nothing but myself, naked to myself. I find that I find no authority for being an authority, no one but myself. I find that if there had been any tyranny over me, it has been the tyranny of myself over myself. I begin to wonder what on earth or in heaven is the root of this idea of authority. And I find no root other than the self. The self as root of self. The self, self-authoritative, self-commanding, self-dictating, self-imposing self on self. And suddenly the question bursts flaming up from my deepest center and illuminates my being. Why have I ever accepted this idea of authority? This concept that there should be power of one being over another, of self over self. And this flaming question consumes my being and demands that I put on another mask. The mask of revolt against even my own authority. The authority of myself over myself. For if I have authority over myself, I divide myself into subject, into ruler self and subject self. And so the nuclear bomb of self-authority explodes, and I am torn from the root of authority and flung into infinity. And there, mysteriously, I survive. I am myself. Whatever I thought was self has vanished. Let still persists. But I cannot hold my old idea of myself or of any self. Now I don't know who is revolting or against what or why. I still lack something. I must move on. But what? Do I need a new mask? Without a mask I shall be infinite, non-manifest, of no effect. The mask is the only way infinity has of presenting within itself a living being. And so, at 126, the eternal light strikes me. I can wear the mask, any mask, at will. Without identification, without loss of my infinity, the game is laid bare. The game is a game, a play, a way in which infinite spirit disports with itself, self-polarized as woman, man, man, woman. And what I had thought was a life, to be taken seriously, is not what I conceived it to be. The goals that I had set up for myself were nothing but plays of light on the surface of the infinite ocean of sentient power. I had not even designed them for myself. They had caught my imagination, not my imagination had constructed them. What I had thought were goals set up for me by my own will were eternal forms of possibilities in the ever-standing infinite field of power, vibrating patterns of the will of the absolute. Oh, what a wonderful release from bondage. The self is a self, not because of itself, but because of the fiat of infinity which delights to play through all possibilities of its sentience and power. I no longer need to strive to free myself from the authority of others or of myself. No one has ever bound me. What I had thought was bondage to others was but the way infinity chooses on some occasion to present itself to itself, some of its possible modes of action. And what I had thought was authority in myself was also just another part of the game that infinite life plays with itself. And from 126 to eternity and infinity, I shall go on, never ceasing to play the game, never ceasing to swim in the infinite ocean of love, which is God. So strange that God should be not some being located somewhere in space as an eternal father figure demanding worship from impotent, finite, sinful creatures, but rather that he is that very sentient love ocean itself, creating by its magical powers all things that are, all creatures that move and live in the world, all maleness and all femaleness inextricably. Strange that God should be as much she as he. Ah, here is comfort indeed for me and for all women. For God himself, the infinite sentient power ocean, names himself in his book as she, he, for this is precisely what the great name of Jehovah signifies. And in him the H is male and the M female. So in my last days, which stretches from 126 years to eternity, I realize what I have been seeking throughout all my other stages. Just a release from the misconception of self. I have seen all selves as beings bound within skins, some tender and thin, some insensitive and thick, and all striving to gain ascendancy, all struggling for supremacy. Now I look at the infinite sentient power ocean of the almighty love of eternity and see all selves as but wavicles in the ever-moving waters. All move for the delight and at the will of the absolute. None move from what they believe is their own power. All power belongs to the almighty absolute. Every own power of a self-wavicle is owed to the absolute power. Oldness nowhere means anything but oldness. Things, beings, creatures, all are but motion patterns in the infinite ocean of sentient spirit power, and whatever they think they own is no more there than a water droplet in the vast Pacific of its own. This insight is the true end of my life. I look back at my long journey through the stages, or I look forward. I see the great wheel of life of Buddha, the chakra of the Indian sages, the Torah law of the Hebrews, the maelstrom of the Norsemen, the logos word of Jesus, and all are the same cycle, all variously named because various names imply various viewpoints and various situations, various conditions and locations. I quickly scan my table of stages, divided into periods 7 years with 3 sevens grouped together to present a logically developed subgroup of the whole process. In the first seven of each group of three, there is an attempt to discover the possibilities of physical body activity. In the second seven, there is a search for ideas about what to do with the gained capacities. And in this search, an acceptance of the self-defined authority's opinions of what is worth doing and what is not. In the third seven is a revolt against these authorities and a movement onwards to the next seven to try the same procedure at a different level. How you might think to yourself, why is this talk the title of Stages of Woman, when, but with slight alterations, it could equally well be called Stages of Man? To this question, I reply that I am a woman and wouldn't presume to present the view of life stages from a man's point of view, even though I have a male function within me. After all, there is some noticeable difference between man and woman, a difference that has led many a rabbi to bemoan the sad plight of a father whose wife gives birth to daughters instead of sons. The rabbis, wishing well to a married man, say, "The Lord keep thee and bless thee with sons, and keep thee from daughters, because they need careful guarding. And the daughter is a vain treasure to her father. From anxiety about her, he does not sleep at night. During her early years, lest she be seduced. In her adolescence, lest she go astray. In her marriageable years, lest she does not find a husband. And when she is married, lest she be childless. And when she is old, lest she practice witchcraft." Well, of course, I accept all this. We women are more vulnerable than men. Wounded from the beginning, and as long as we remain women, still woundable, we do need careful guarding. We have not the anchor of intellectuality so strongly as men have. We live more in our bodies. While men live in abstract ideas, we live in our feelings and emotions, and less in the logic by which men pride themselves, and this not by our own will, but by the will of God. The abstract mental processes of men would carry them away from Mother Earth, back too quickly to their Heavenly Father, as happened to Abel, if it were not for the continuous will to embodiment which orientates woman. Without women to draw men into the processes necessary for the creation of physical bodies, humanity would long ago have vanished from the face of the earth. Not accidentally was it Eve who gave ear to the serpent whose advice cast her and her husband out of the Garden of Eden. With her began the population of the earth, which thus would later give house room to the mighty men of old, whose deeds today we still sing as worthy of admiration. And so, Eve-like, I accept my vulnerability and believe that God has not given it to me for nothing. It has given me the power to understand the language of serpents. It has allowed women to be doors through which myriads of men have marched from eternity into time. As for myself, having chosen not to be such a door, it has been given to me to see my stages more clearly than I might have done. And I see that some of us are able to use our vulnerability in ways not followed by others of the same sex. For God uses us all, each in a special way. Shall I say something of the great age to which we may live before reaching our goal of freedom from all finite authorities? I suppose that some of you would like to shorten the course. Mm-hmm. Well, it's possible to do so, but only by a kind of super effort, which most of us don't seem inclined to make. Make haste slowly, says a proverb, and I for one think there's some sense in this, providing that it is haste that we make. Tardiness can prolong the way as much as hasting can shorten it. But always it is divine grace which decides for us at any given moment which we shall choose. There is, of course, again by grace, the provision of a quick way, an immediate way to the goal. It is the way of deliberate standing still and letting things happen through us. It is a way known more to women than to men. But the standing still must not be static. In it we must be absolutely alert, sensitive to the moment's possibility, and ready to be doorways to them. For this, we must not be afraid. Perfect love casts out fear. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but only its beginning and not its end. Perfect love, love and do what you will, is the cosmic law. And as a woman, I prefer to say, love and let God do what he will. But this, of course, is because I love my vulnerability, if it will place me at God's mercy. But there's a dialectic in this. For God has given us all a will and requires us to use it as if we were free, although never for a moment letting us out of his open hand. So we are to act as if we belong to ourselves, although in fact we belong to him. And in this again, women are more apt than men, for men find it much harder to believe that they belong to God. For God has deprived them of much of their vulnerability by encasing their brains in logic. But here, they are vulnerable to reason. At birth, our vulnerability is obvious. We can do nothing to guarantee our own survival. And this is so even for the boy child. But soon the difference between boys and men become obvious. The physiological difference of little boys has its psychological correspondence. They aggress against the things of the world almost as from the moment they sit up and grasp their little rattle. They can feel their power of attack much more than their vulnerability. But we females feel our vulnerability, and not only at our first entry into the cold outer world. We feel it all our lives, and come quickly to accept it as our lot. Yet our vulnerability is not all lost. It sharpens our senses. It quickens our perceptions, extends our feeling power into the surrounding space, and makes us much more aware than men of psychic forces. And such forces exist. Not for nothing did the rabbis warn of the old woman's capacity for the witch's art. But here again is a dialectic. Our extra sensitivity to psychic forces may trap us into openness to influences of which the intellectual encasedness of men makes them oblivious. Wind all the anchorage we can get if we are to survive in the strange, wayward psychic currents of the ocean. He that would swim must first become a fish. Is an old proverb. Fish, as you symbolists know, means emotional immediacy. We must become immediately aware of the psychic forces and impulses that momently assail us. And we must prefer to be able to swim in this infinite ocean of energy that constitutes the universe. Passivity to its every current is not God's intention for us. Passivity, which is merely passivity, unwilled and unaware, is the way to lostness. Here, our vulnerability is our enemy. Here, we can remember Spinoza's words. Adequate knowledge equals activity equals happiness. Inadequate knowledge equals passivity equals misery. Adequate knowledge may sound a very masculine expression to the dreaming feminine soul, but it can be translated in an acceptable way. We vulnerable ones can gain adequate feeling evaluations of our type and level of vulnerability. We can even, in moments of extreme self-honesty, trace our vulnerability to its source. In the beginning of sexual differentiation of the prime monocell in the ocean in which our protoplasmic life started, sex and feeling were inseparable. We still hear lovers say to each other, "I could eat you." And Jesus said, "If you do not eat of my body and drink of my blood, you have no part in me." When two primitive monocells met, they tried to eat each other. The more compact, swifter cell bit the larger, less compact and slower one. The slower one responded by opening up and trying to engulf the other. The one that opened up was the first mother of all women. Since those days, the more compact and swifter ones have developed a philosophy and technique of hit and run. The less compact have found their own methods of response. Millions of years of this dual behavior have brought the human race to its present facility in survival and developmental techniques. Because heredity and dual parentage are facts, none of us today can truly consider ourselves free from the ambiguities of bisexuality. Inside every man is a hidden woman, and inside every woman, a man. And it is for us to bring ourselves to admit this fact, and so to free ourselves from the misconception of unmixed gender. But most men are frightened of admitting their inner womanness, for to them this would be a confession of their vulnerability. And we women must be careful also, for if we allow our maleness to show on the outside, we can frighten the inner vulnerability of the female in men. And our evolutionary work is not yet finished. We have still to draw men into incarnation, into embodiment on earth. This is our divinely appointed duty.
None of them, some geniuses, can actually count with invisible fingers so that everybody thinks they're counting in another way. They count on imaginary fingers. Some can actually do algebra. But behind everything, we begin by counting on our fingers. When we run out of fingers, we count on toes. So a very, very primitive count would be 10 and then 20. Count everything we've got that's separable. And there is the basis of our count. We are looking at energy that has already done something. It has grown in this way in order to function in this way, so that when we look at it, we are looking at an energy that fulfills functions by the way it organizes itself. Now, if a thing fulfills a function from within itself, we call it intelligence. The tao in intelligence means purpose. Telos is purpose. Intelligence means the essence which finds a purpose in itself. So if we say an energy produces from inside itself a function which fulfills a purpose, we are required to define this energy as intelligent. If instead of saying energy, which means affirming work into something, we generalize it more and more and finish up with the idea of power, meaning that pushing mysterious X that makes the globe rotate, that carries it round the sun, that makes shoots come out of the ground in the spring. There is a pusher in nature, and this pusher we call power. This power, when it is involved in work, we call energy. When it is applied in a particular situation to a particular object, we call it a force. The FO in force and the PO in power actually have the same origin. So when we say that which has within itself the capacity to function towards the fulfillment of a purpose is intelligent, and everywhere in living organisms we find fulfillment of purpose is there, which maintains the life of a being, we have to say this energy, this power, is intelligent. Now, wisdom is concerned with the totality of all the forms and their mutual implications. So we have to say, as all functions everywhere are the behaviors of energy, and when we use this word power, this pushing X, this mysterious something that pushes everything around in the universe, we have to say that there is an infinite intelligent power. It is intelligent because it fulfills a function. Then we can ask ourselves a question which a lot of scientific minds would say, don't ask that question because you have no ground to believe it. Is a man intelligent? Yes, because he works towards the realization of a purpose. Is the earth intelligent? Well, of course not. The earth is not intelligent. But the earth is the precondition of organic life on the earth, and that organic life is purposeful. Now, if the purpose in the plant, the animal, and man spring out of the earth, and realizing themselves on the earth, standing upon the earth with the earth as their basis, with all their chemistry derived from the earth, which is a mass in the solar system, one time not solid, but diffused throughout the solar system itself, are we not compelled logically to say that the power which produced the man on the earth is an intelligent power? If so, then the solar nebula from which this planetary system derived was an intelligent power. We can then talk about solar intelligence. We can talk about the whole solar system as an intelligent being. And we can think about that plasma, that very, very fine energy, which at one time is an incandescent mass, shaped roughly like the solar system is now. But the planet's not yet cooled, but the matter of the planet, remember, matter is energy, the energy of those planets, not yet cooled, still a part, obviously, in dynamic interrelation with the whole field of solar energy. And it is moving towards producing intelligent beings, one of which is man. It is therefore an intelligent power, a solar power, producing man on earth. You can then see how in the ancient world those priesting scientists who understood that fact quite clearly said that they were sons of the sun. They actually called themselves solar beings. And anybody who didn't know that fact, then they would say they are sons of the moon. Where the moon, as you know, hasn't got any organic life on it, doesn't grow any plants or animals or men, and therefore symbolizes the type of energy locked up, not yet producing. That it will produce in the future, if you live long enough, you will see. You've already seen the first step to occupying it. You can't conceive that men are not going to do something with it and use it Grow things on it, establish on it a life pattern and so on. But at the moment, it is inert. And it is phasic, it is periodic, and it is peculiarly related to moods of the sea on Earth. So it is used as a symbol of a kind of life that as near as you can get to it is mechanical, considering that all energy is intelligent at base. There we see in the moon a sort of term of involution, where the free intelligent power, the solar power, has brought itself down, progressively condensing itself until it has immobilized itself to the greatest degree. And the moon symbolizes, therefore, that approximation to total immobility, as near as we can get to it. What we have then is a kind of large atom going round in an orbit and presenting the same face to the Earth continually. Cannot develop itself in the way that it might develop if it had been a bit farther away, had rotated on its axis, had its own night and day, had an atmosphere. If it had had those things, it might have already grown some plants, some animals, and so on. But it hasn't yet. It's 1/6 the mass of the Earth, and its atmosphere, such as it was robbed from it because of its too close proximity to the Earth. So there we see two ways now of thinking. One is a way where we look externally at the thing and be pleased we can take it to pieces. The other is one in which we look at it and we identify with it and we say that all the brilliant arrangements and articulations and organizations within these things are there for us to look at. We didn't put them there, they're there. We discover them there because they're there. And they are put there by an intelligent involving power. And its greatest depth of involution is represented by the moon, with no organic life on it that we can see. Now, the way of the moon is the way of routine, is the way of phasic changes conditioned by a law of the rotation of that body around the Earth. So that the way of the moon, in yoga that is Pitriyana, the way of the ancestors, and the way of the sun were two exactly opposite ways. The way of the sun is the way of the affirmation of freedom. Surya, the sun, affirming free. Yana, a way. Surayana is a way of affirming freedom. The other way is to be in a routine way of behavior, and to believe that you cannot get out of that routine. A mechanistic behaviorist will solemnly assure you that you cannot do anything unless you are stimulated, and you cannot do anything except react to the kind of stimulus that you get in accordance with the organism, which is already a product, according to them, of blind forces of evolution. If you believe that you are conditioned in that way, your own belief will condition you. You will actually behave as if you are enslaved by natural laws, by gravity, by laws of electromagnetic distribution, by laws of chemistry, and so on. If you believe it, the idea that you are enslaved will enslave you. And you are then on the way of the moon. You are on the way of the ancestors. The equation of the moon and the ancestors is quite simple. They said ancestors, fathers and mothers, generally wish children to obey them. But if the children obey their earthly ancestors, and their earthly ancestors have adjusted to a certain kind of way of living, which they have learned, and because they have learned it, they think it's the way. If the parents impose on the children, and the children behave in the same way as the parents, then there will be an exact repetition from generation to generation of a behavior which in effect would mean mechanism. So that way of the moon, of that non-growing thing which repeatedly goes through certain phases, increasing and decreasing. That way was also called the way of their ancestors, the Pitris or fathers. Think of that very carefully now, because when we look inside the human being, we see certain things, and they are there already for us to see. Let's look at our body. Throughout the whole of our body, we see that we have a stuff called, loosely, flesh. A biologist would call it protoplasm, the original plastic substance of life. And then ask yourself why this protoplasm has gathered itself together in this way, why it has bothered to dress itself up in our hemisphere, put clothes on it, why does it protect itself? And we find this protoplasm is full of purpose. And we find, if we trace it back to its beginnings, an egg inside another piece of protoplasm called mother. This egg somehow mysteriously took a piece of protoplasm, quite small, barely visible to the naked eye, and proceeded to develop itself, to organize itself, to divide itself internally, and every subdivision that it makes is functional, purpose fulfilling. So we have to say this protoplasm is shot through and through with purpose, and therefore with intelligence. We have to say the protoplasm of our body is a substance giving concrete evidence of intelligent working energy. Now we observe another thing. If this protoplasm had not got a bony structure inside it, would it not be using energy more to sit up than it does now that it has a spine? Tell me, if you've got a spine in you, is it easier to sit up or harder? Easier. So you have to say that the bones in the body fulfill a special function. They have been posited inside the protoplasm by the protoplasmic intelligence, which is all one with the solar intelligent power, which is all one with the universal intelligent power, which religionists call God and philosophers might call first cause. And we have to say that the bones have been posited inside that protoplasm merely for economic reasons. If I've got a bone in my arm and I turn my hand up like that, now my elbow won't bend backwards, so I don't tire in that part of my arm in holding it up as much as I would if I held it like that, by gravity pulling it down. You do that with your arm, put an arm out, bang somebody under the nose next to you, turn your palm up and feel that your elbow joint is carrying the weight of that arm. And turn it over the other way and feel that dangle. Feel how you expend energy to hold it up that way. Aren't you saving energy when you hold your palm up? Yes? So think about the bones in your body simply as economic methods of maintaining postures, which would require greater energy expenditure if you hadn't made those bones. And think that the power that originally was in the universe that made the solar system, that cooled itself in this zone and made an earth, that on this zone organized plants, animals and men, this energy is still with us, working in us now, and is intelligent. So that we are not in any way separated from the power of the universe that created the star system, the solar system, the planetary system, organic life on earth, and thus we are still in contact with that power. And that power is working intelligently in us. And then look at your nervous system. Those of you who have studied any nervous physiology have probably been taught that the nerves are means whereby you communicate, send messages from the brain to parts of the body. Is that right, Dr. Clover? So is that right, Dr. Wilson? Now, in fact, it isn't so. Something quite different. Before you had a nervous system, your protoplasm was able to send messages all over itself, wasn't it? You know that because I'm unable to do it, can't it? Has he got an error system, Dr. Glover? Not defined as such. That's very careful. She's a little bit careless. Perhaps 10 years ago she might have said, certainly it has not. And she's a bit wary now. Not defined as such. It doesn't show under the microscope, does it? No. Not the ordinary sort. And yet this amoeba, which is only a monocell spreading itself out in search of food and delight, carries messages all over itself throughout its protoplasm. And this same protoplasm has laid down the nervous system. Why has it done it? Answer, Dr. Clover, why has it done it? Economy, yes. As a matter of fact, once you've laid down a nerve tract, you can insert a little bit of energy at the top end and it will go down without bothering and wiggle your finger. It's an economic method of separating out functions. It is not actually a method of communication at all. It's a method of non-communication to the other parts that you don't wish to communicate with. Because all the nerve lines are insulated. So this energy inserted at the top end does not leak out on the way down until it comes to its particular turn. Is that right? Is there a doctor in the house? Trevor. You know a lot about nervous systems, don't you? Something. Is the nerve line insulated?
It has a sheath.
What's the function of that sheath?
The messages that flow along the nerve, traveling down the root of
this. Along the nerve.
Along the nerve.
So it doesn't leak out sideways.
Yes.
And this insulation was laid down by the intelligence that generated this protoplasm. So we have to say that just as the bones are an economic method of saving energy, so the nervous system is an economic way of saving energy. More specifically. Now remember, you could use them specifically before you had the nervous system. All it's done is enable you to lay habit patterns. So you don't need to attend to them anymore. When you see a little baby trying to walk, it uses a lot of muscles that it doesn't need in order to walk, including pulling its tongue out, rolling its eyes, and so on, grabbing at the air. It progressively eliminates those that do not conduce to walking, and it leaves the ones that conduce to walking connected up. So the moment the idea, I will walk, comes in, immediately there is a programmed direction of nervous impulsation, and walking occurs. So the actual separation out of the function is already inherent in the protoplasm, made by that intelligent power. Now that being so, we're facing a peculiar thing, and that is that the field of energy, because when we're talking about living substances of protoplasm, we know they're held together by biomagnetic fields. That field of energy must be already structured. We can't lay down these bones except within a pattern. We can't lay down this nervous system except within a pattern. Think of those eggs lying comfortably in mother, waiting to be born. You're an empirical scientist, you steal one in the night, put it under the microscope, peer down it, what do you find? You don't find any visible bones or nervous system. And yet, if you treat it very carefully and incubate it, feed it, it will grow them. Now, where is the pattern of the human being when, physically, we cannot see it, in the physical body of that protoplasmic egg? Where is it? It must be in the field. So the field itself must be structured. So that when we're talking about this solar power, this universal power, we're not talking about floppy energy meandering about. We are talking about a power which is infinitely structured. It's got its own structure which can be the plan on which later it lays down a nervous system. Yes? So we have to say that the field of the infinite power is infinitely structured. When we say infinitely structured, we mean that it contains every conceivable form, whatever you can imagine, no matter how funny it is, whether it's centaurs or millipedes, elephants, butterflies, whatever it is, that infinite field of power already has within it the structure of that being. Now, yoga philosophy is a philosophy telling you a procedure and a theoretical background to enable you to become aware of this structure and to do so by means of your body. You know, there's a nice little expression, yoga bahoga. Yoga means conjoining with your source, yoking to the absolute power, and bahoga means enjoy it. It actually means as you become aware that your body is nothing but embodied intelligence, embodied structure, embodied function. As you become aware of it, instead of thinking of it as an alien thing, something that somehow you fell into, you begin to see that this body is intelligent, structural, purposeful power, self-precipitated, concreted as a body. You then begin to see what was meant by many mystics. From Blake was one, Jacob Burma another, Shakespeare another, to say that this body is spirit. That the dualism made by certain religionists of spirit and matter is false. It is non-dual. Your body is spirit because it is structured, because it is functional. Think very carefully about that, because a lot of religion had a function in the ancient world of making people behave who could not understand at their then level the fact that body was spirit. Imagine people who thought that their body was a pleasure mechanism that they could use and bind themselves into the body because of the pleasure. And they couldn't understand that this pleasure itself was a device of spirit to ensure attendance to the body. And they became so locked in the pleasure cycles of the body that they couldn't turn round and look at the source part. You see that? Because sometimes you have to account for strange statements made by religious leaders in the ancient world which are quite untrue if taken at their external significance. Namely, the idea that there is a spirit world, and the idea that there is a material world, and the idea that these two worlds are at war with each other. Where St. Paul says the spirit lusts against the flesh, and the flesh against the spirit. And he sees a war in the members. And he postulates this. Why? Because of identification. How many of you know the story of the god Indra getting into the body of a pig? Do we all know it? Well, if there's only one who doesn't know it, then we have to tell the story. There was a great god named Indra, very famous amongst the gods, and he was meandering about one day and he saw a pig. And he thought, what a wonderfully powerful animal, so full of vitality, fat. And he descended into it to see what it was like. And he found it felt marvelous, dashing about, with tusks, tearing up the trees, having a fine time. And he became so delighted with this pig existence, the idea that he was Indra, the great god, began to faint. And he met a lady pig. And then it faded even more. And then he got little piglets, and it faded more. And he lost his divine vocabulary, and all he could do was grunt. Meanwhile, the divine messenger was skating about, and in heaven there had been an alarm. And this divine messenger said, well, actually, he's in a pig's body, and he's forgotten he's a god. So all the gods went down and began to talk to him, saying, Lord Indra, come out of that pig's body. You've been in there long enough. Heaven is falling apart. The administration's really going to pieces. Come back. And he replied, so they thought, this is ridiculous. The fellow's identified. Now, identification is the key to all misery. Tell me, thought. And by what you may fall, you may rise. If you identify with an object, you go under the law governing that object. But if you identify with free spirit, then you go under the law of free spirit. But it's either or. You identify with a form, or you identify with intelligence. Anyhow, Indra could only grunt, so they killed all his little piglets, whereupon he snorted and grunted and got very annoyed, but he still remained piggy. So then they killed the wife. So he snorted more, started looking for another wife. He was apparently incurable. So they killed him. They ripped open the body of the pig and they dragged him out. And then he saw that he was Indra, the great god. And he apologized for his rudery. That's another god, Rudra. And promised not to identify with pigs anymore. And they went back to heaven and the administration was put in order.